This is Echo Zoe Radio, episode 86, for June 2015 with Fred Butler on 20 Ways to Answer a Fool.
Welcome to Echo Zoe Radio, the podcast outreach of Echo Zoe Ministries, where you'll hear about important topics affecting the church today. Our primary goal is to explore a variety of issues while remaining faithful to God and His Word. Stay with us for the next hour as your host, Andy Olson, shares his conversation with this month's guest. Here's your host, Andy Olson.
I'm Andy Olson. Thanks for listening to Echo Zoe Radio. This is episode 86 for June 2015. Fred Butler returns for this episode to discuss a series of articles he wrote for his blog in which he responded to specific objections to Christianity that were leveled by an atheist. The objections were not uncommon and provide a good template for demonstrating the thinking and argumentation that is used in objections to Christianity. You can find a link to Fred's articles along with the show notes that include an outline of this discussion, a list of scriptures referenced, additional resources, and related episodes of this podcast at echozoe.com/86. Before we get started, I want to mention Jerusalem's King, the film that was produced by the Mount Moriah Foundation and in association with Echo Zoe Ministries. The film tells the redemption story and spans biblical history from creation to the millennial reign of Christ. A digital download version of the film is available now in the Echo Zoe store, and your purchase supports Echo Zoe Ministries. I highly recommend it, and for just $2 for standard definition or $3 for high definition, it's a bargain. If DVD or Blu-ray are more to your liking, both options are available at JerusalemsKing.com, also very reasonably priced, and the proceeds from sales at that site will go to support ministry efforts at the Mount Moriah Foundation, which you can learn more about at MountMoriahFoundation.org. Also, if you're in the Twin Cities metro area on August 15th, Ryan Habana, who was the primary producer of Jerusalem's King, will be joining Alan Kirshner for a Bible prophecy conference in Eagan. You can get more information for that at alankirshner.com. That's Alan, KURSCHNER.com. Alan will also be joining me in studio while he's in town for a podcast on Bible prophecy from a premillennial, pre-wrath point of view. If you have any questions for Alan for that podcast, please contribute them either via social media or email. You can email at echozoe.com/contact. With that, here's my discussion with Fred Butler. Fred Butler, it's a pleasure to have you back. It's been a little over a year since we did our King James only version.
Yes, it's been a
podcast.
Yeah, that was last
May.
I think it was like in 2013. No, it was, that's right.
It was
that's
May
right.
of 2014.
I'm confusing you with somebody else, I think.
Oh, I'm not the only podcast you go on?
Yeah, I think it was one other podcast. I've only done like two or three. And the other one was on King James only stuff too, I think. That must have been back in December, I think, of 2013. So it's been a while for that. So yeah.
Well, it's great to have you back. You know, I've really enjoyed one thing I love about the podcast is getting to know people, and it's both the people I do interviews with and listeners. I get occasional listeners will reach out and stuff, and I love that. I just love getting to know the brethren on both sides of that equation.
That's the positive side of social media.
Yeah, I just had a brother from Denmark reached out about a week or two ago, and we were chatting on Twitter. And wow. Armin, if you're listening, I enjoyed our conversation, and thanks for reaching out. So this episode, this month, we're going to talk about you've got a series of blog posts that you did called 20 Ways to Answer a Fool.
That is correct.
And you interacted with an atheist who was rather typical, but also rather rabid.
Right. Chaz Buffet. I think that's how you say his last name.
Okay.
I'm not sure. B-U-F-E, however you pronounce that. Buffet.
Yeah, that's a...
I'm not sure. Anyway. Yeah, well, the The blog articles really started probably 2005-ish maybe is when I wrote those originally. Uh-huh. Because I was looking to basically start new stuff for my blog. I had just basically started the blog, and I was starting to write a little bit. I wanted to have some outlet for my theological, I don't know, pearls of wisdom or whatever. And somehow I got linked from some website to an atheist website. And in the sidebar of that atheist website, I saw linked to the 20 Reasons to Abandon Christianity written by Chaz, the blues-playing anarchist, as I'd like to call him, mm-hmm. who was arguing, 20 reasons why we need to just totally get rid of Christianity. It needs to be, kicked off the planet kind of stuff. And I think the notes in the sidebar, if I'm not mistaken, they had like a description of the booklet and just raved about how wonderful it was and just had this great argumentation. And it's one of the best takedowns of Christianity or something like that. And well, hey, I've got a brand new blog, so I want to read the greatest arguments to take down Christianity. Maybe I can write about this. So I linked over there, and apparently you can buy this booklet. He also gives a print version of this, but it's there online. It's still active link. Even after 10 years, it's still available online if anybody wanted to go and see it. And he laid out, his 20 reasons why we should abandon Christianity. And really, I'm not even really sure what we're supposed to replace it with. I guess we're just supposed to get rid of Christianity altogether. Religion in general, I suppose. His main target was primarily Roman Catholicism. I don't know if that's because he was raised as Catholic or had nuns beat him in parochial school or whatever.
Well, they're kind of an easy target when you get into, especially get into some of his points. I mean, it's... You got to go hard Catholic to make some of the points that he makes.
And I think there was even one or two points where I'm like, well, hey, yeah, if we're talking about Roman Catholics, I agree with you. I'm right there with you. I'll be happy to stand and condemn them just like you're condemning them. But that's not biblical Christianity.
Yep.
And so I started taking on each one of his main reasons. That's 20 of them. And so playing off Psalm 14:1, where it talks about the fool has said in his heart. I kind of played off that title a little bit and just said 20 ways to answer a fool. Mm-hmm. And I understand in scripture that a fool is not somebody who's stupid or just ignorant or there's somebody who, or just needs to be educated, but it's really describing an individual who has really at enmity with God. We're all at enmity with God, but there's someone who has specifically chosen to actively rebel against God. And we see condemnations of the fool all through Proverbs, all through Psalms. It talks about the one who did not, they say that there is no God. And it doesn't mean that they're like, well, I haven't seen the compelling evidence that God exists. I've looked all over the place and, I'm just not convinced. That's not what a fool is, but it's somebody who knows God is there and they
suppress the truth and unrighteousness.
Express the truth and unrighteousness. One of my favorite passages, in the ESV, actually, that translation is Proverbs 19:30, where it talks about how, the way of the fool brings him to ruin, but his heart rages against the Lord. So if you have a foolish person who makes unwise life choices and basically takes this path of self-destruction, well, rather than looking back and saying, wow, man, I really made a mistake and I should go back and, learn from this. No, he's going to argue and shout against God. How dare you do this to me? You shouldn't have let me have this wreck after I got drunk and was driving 100 miles an hour down the freeway or whatever it is. And my thinking when I started these articles was, not only did I need good blog fodder, to start writing and have something to kind of post on my blog, but I started to think that I believe a lot of Christians were like me growing up, where you probably encountered, you know, one of these crusty atheist types at your family reunions, particularly at Thanksgiving or Christmas. You see these people, you see that one cousin, you know, who was always headed in for church and he hated church or whatever, or he, you know, whatever it might be. And it would be on Thanksgiving, Christmas, maybe every other year you might see them. And he would goad people into arguments about the Bible or about some point of theology, probably some of the more bizarre conversations I've had about the Bible were right after we had our Thanksgiving dinner and we're sitting in the living room under the influence of tryptophan as it's running through our bodies, making us sleepy and watching football. And then you're going to have that person start piping up about how, you know, Jesus is a crutch or whatever it is, or they start raising a lot of the objections that Chaz wrote in his little booklet. And so I thought, well, you know, I want to answer this guy primarily for readers who might see these here sometime. They'll come across them and they're going to encounter that person at the family reunion or the community college or, you know, the dorm room roommate, whoever it might be, and they don't really have a ready answer to kind of respond to this person. It's not that you're trying to convince them per se, as it is you want to give them something to think about, that there are answers to these objections, and that you turn it around on them and you just show them, you look, the way that you're thinking is just as foolish, if you want to consider it that way. And it's silly. It leads to absurdity to think this way. So that was sort of my goal and my objective with writing these articles. I think when I originally started them, I sent Chaz a few emails because I think it was a contact page. And even when I republished them on WordPress, because I originally put these on Blogger, and when I moved over to a different blogging platform, I I reposted them, what you're kind of looking at now, to kind of make them look better and frame them up and to kind of punch up the material, check the links, make sure none of them were dead or anything. And I emailed him again, said, hey, I wrote a response to your booklet, and he never got back with me. So I, you know, I don't know if the guy is still alive or, you know, what that is exactly, but he was not interested. So I don't know. If somebody wants to send along this podcast to their, you know, to his website, he has a online website where he publishes anarchist materials and atheist materials. You know, maybe he'll give it a listen or something. I don't know.
Yeah, and we'll have links. You know, my listeners know that I like to do a pretty thorough show notes with every episode, and this one being number 86 will be echozoe.com/86. If you're our live YouTube viewer, that's not going to go anywhere now, but once the final episode is posted, we'll do echozoe.com/86. I'll have the links to your articles as well, and then you can follow through to find the original that Fred here is responding to. But I thought this follows really very closely to what I did with Tony Miano just 2 months ago when we did Misconceptions About Christianity. The stuff that Tony and I talked about was a little bit more not so hostile, you know, I guess is the way to put it. This is definitely hostile. There's a couple points that overlap. We get into slavery and misogyny. Overlaps. But for the most part, this stuff that you did was different points. And I think it's important for Christians to understand how to answer this stuff. And I hope most of my listeners already do, but it never hurts to listen. And hopefully you know somebody you can pass along to.
You always want to be learning and growing. And it's not that I have the greatest answers. With a lot of these little points that I had written up, I'm sure you could find other more detailed responses. My thinking is just sort of the, you know, kind of a quick assurance for the believer that you're not an idiot, like this guy is claiming, but also to kind of give you some, you know, bullets to kind of give some quick ammunition to, you know, respond whenever you're in the hallway or wherever it is where someone raises, well, isn't Christianity, don't they sanction slaves? And they, you know, you could sell your daughters into slavery and all this other kind of stuff. And, you know, you want to be able to answer that in a, from scripture and just show them that, no, that's not what the Bible teaches at all. So,
right. Well, maybe, you know, because there's 20 and I don't know that we'll have time to get through it. You know, hopefully we will, but, well, we should probably just jump in and maybe start walking through some of these points, because I think it's great to understand what the argument is and how to respond to it. But he starts off his first one. He says that Christianity is based on fear.
Yeah, and I guess he was trying to get across the idea, and this is where he goes into bashing the Roman Catholics a little bit. And he was kind of given the idea that, well, you know, the reason why, you know, people are Christians is because you have these priests that basically inspire terror into the hearts of children by telling them stories about devils and hell and all of these horrible things about the afterlife and judgment and God's going to get you. And that's the only reason why people really want to be religious anyways, because they have a fear of the unknown. And these fundamentalist preachers will oftentimes play on that fear, and they use that to manipulate, you know, their followers to just live in this, you know, this prison, a psychological prison of terror. It was kind of his take on it. And I responded to that by saying, well, you know, there's a little bit of truth to that. And I don't necessarily disagree with him. I think that the Roman Catholics probably do that with their, you know, if you do certain sins, well, you know, the devils are going to come and rend your soul and take you to hell. I come from a fundamentalist background. I don't know what background you particularly come from, but growing up, I, you know, I sat under a lot of these, what really amounted to a Christian youth group version of all of those old traffic safety films, if you remember,
yeah,
where they would show you these graphic, you know,
Alice's trip through the windshield. What was that Simpsons about?
There's all kinds of, you know, the red asphalt and highway of blood, you know, and it was supposed to scare you in, into driving safely.
Yeah.
And, well, we had those kind of stories. We had the youth evangelist who would come, and he would, you know, talk about these apocryphal urban legend like stories about the kid who, you know, went to the rock concert and whatever, and on the way home got in an accident. And as the ambulance drivers were, you know, taking him, he was screaming, oh, I'm in hell, you know, take all the demons.
It's like a chick track.
Yeah, yeah, those kind of thing. Well, that stuff, I agree with you. That stuff is ridiculous.
Yep.
My faith in the Word of God should not be turned into, you know, being fearful in an in that kind of ridiculous, really superstitious fashion. Mm-hmm. I even recount a story in the in this post about how I remember. I had a friend who claimed that he went to the Bill Gothard training stuff, and he told the story about how these Cabbage Patch dolls that were popular a long time ago, you know, they all had demons attached to them because they had, some of them were named after these Hindu gods or Buddhist gods. And this one particular doll was given to this daughter, to this girl, and she stopped eating, and all of these people were, you know, what's going on? Why is she, you know, doesn't want to eat? And the parents happen to finally come to their wits' end. They take her to the doctor, and he noticed that the doctor just so happened to be a Bill Gothard trained Bible Institute instructor.
Wow.
Man, how providential is that? Yeah. And he noticed that she had a Cabbage Patch doll. Immediately he said, what is the name of your doll? And it's the Hindu god of famine.
Oh, wow.
And you need to go home and burn that doll in the trash can, and then it'll break the curse. And that's what they did. And voila, the girl was healed and she started eating again. You know, it's that kind of goofy stuff. But we don't base our faith on that. That is a ridiculous notion that, you know, it just shows the ignorance of Chaz, really, that, you know, that's not what Christianity is based upon. It's based upon, yes, I would say a healthy fear of God, but it's a fear that is, you know, recognizing that he's our creator, he's our sovereign, but he's also the one who gives us salvation. He is the one who has given us Christ. And when I come to God and I want to be saved, I'm not coming to him because I'm fearful of, you know, being torn to hell by demons, though we would acknowledge a, you know, a biblical understanding of God's wrath and hell.
Yeah.
But I, that's not
the thing. Ironically, it's those who are most should be afraid of God are the ones that are least likely to be afraid of him.
Oh yeah, you're exactly right. And, it's, yeah, that one, that particular one, I just thought was, I kind of agreed with him, but then I'm like, you know, hey, what, you're being a little ridiculous and you're not,
well, all really of these are really, I got through about 18. I was just finishing up before I called, but,
there was a few of them I combined together because he was just repetitive and I just sort of treated them under one, under one post.
Yep. So he says that Christianity preys on the innocent. You kind of picked up on that already a little bit. But.
Yeah, that has to do. It's kind of the same idea. And I got that picture of that child about to break into tears there in front of my thing. But yeah, it's the same idea too. It's that it's individuals, again, who are already prone to fear. And they're going to, and he's kind of focusing his thoughts towards the little kids. You're terrorizing children. Mm-hmm. That you're producing them along, you're producing in them these kids that are going to be essentially afraid of God, and that they're gonna, you know, these little kids, that she should be nurturing them and educating them and loving them and all of that kind of thing. Well, you know, the whole point of the of you doing that is so that you're really trying to terrorize them to get them to love God or to follow this particular priest. And you know, again, there's really no, I sort of answered him a little bit in the first point.
Mm-hmm.
What I sort of pointed out with him, though, is how, you know, Chaz is a self-identifying anarchist, and he promotes Marxist viewpoints, and he's, you know, that's his political philosophy. And it's almost like he is completely, how would you say? I probably self-imposed myopia on regarding history, you know?
There's a lot of projection going on. You know, it's like all of his worst traits get projected onto us.
I know. And I kind of pointed out that, hey, you know, these people like Karl Marx and Jean-Jacques Rousseau, they basically took the whole idea of these philosophies, and some of these men, like Pol Pot is the one example that I used, who went in taking Marxism and Rousseau's blank slate philosophy and all of that, and he brought it to Cambodia, and one of the first thing he did after he killed all the Christians was to get all the youth and to create this, you know, these jackbooted thug youth army that went around and instilled terror into all the normal people's lives. Mm-hmm. If you remember that old film, The Killing Fields, there's a really amazing scene where he's, you know, where the character who's been left behind and he's in one of these camps, re-education camps. The one little semblance of civilization that he had was this tomato plant that he was kind of growing and nourishing. Nurturing, and outside the door of his camp, and there's a scene where he's outside, and the army guys come up and they bring him outside and standing there in front of his tomato plant, and this 13-year-old girl comes in and tears it up and stomps all over it, and it's like, well, you know, what kind of, you know, that's obviously a movie, but that kind of stuff went on. I mean, aren't you doing the same thing as the anarchists and the atheists, is you're taking these youth and you're creating these monsters with your philosophy? I mean, that's what you see in history with some of these atheistic political nations, like in Russia. And I mean, even the Nazis had their, you know, brown, what was it, the brown shirts. Yeah. And they had their Hitler's youth guys. I mean, that stuff is there. You can't deny that. And to say that it's Christians that are, you know, the only ones who bear this guilt is a little, it's just blinding to your, you know, the facts, as it were.
Well, that makes the next one really big. It's based on Christianity's based on dishonesty.
Yes, because Christians, you know, they're going to tell you that, you know, you need to believe in God, and, you know, somehow there's this bait and switch thing. And the example that he kind of used was Pascal's wager. And I should have gone back and when I responded to this and maybe
he must have gone to Rick Warren's church or something.
Yeah, I know. And he goes to Pascal's white wager, which I guess is popular among a lot of classic apologist types, maybe.
Okay.
Well, he goes to Pascal's wager, which is basically the idea that it's, you know, well, it's better for me to believe in God and die knowing, you know, if I was wrong, well, you know, it's not, there's nothing lost. But if I don't believe in God and I die, well, then, man, I've lost everything because I'm going to be, you know, turned into hell. Basically, what I did when I responded to him is I just kind of pointed out that one of the problems with atheism is that they, whereas they're going to accuse the Christians of believing in, you know, some kind of fantasy God man or whatever, what they're calling you to believe in is not necessarily any better, if you want to call it that. I mean, in fact, it would be absolutely worse because really there's nothing there. And when you, I often challenge atheists on social media if they come across them, you know, maybe leaving nasty comments in the AIG Twitter feed or something. But I just sort of pointed out, you know, it's like when you're an atheist and you're claiming that there's evolution, and one of the things I always tell folks whenever I'm engaging them is these atheists, you know, you're basically telling me that I'm evolved stardust when it comes down to it, that somehow millions of years ago, you know, the conditions were just right so that stardust that seeded our planet was able to bring about evolution. That's an amazing amount of blind faith. Now, you can believe your scientist heroes who are telling you, oh yeah, this is the way we read the data and we got all this, you know, quote, evidence. But really, you're telling me that millions of years and just the right conditions and that brought us, you know, basically from bacteria to Bach, you know, who writes his wonderful concertos. I just don't see that. And one of the things I did is I ended that post by quoting from a guy named Richard Lewontin. I think I'm pronouncing his name correct, Lewontin, who was a, he's a biologist, if I'm not mistaken, but he wrote a review of Carl Sagan's, old book called Demon Haunted World, where basically Carl Sagan, you know, laid out similar complaints against the religion and Christianity as Chaz is doing. And Richard, basically gave some rather telling, revelations, if you were, about what it is he believes as an atheist. And he basically said, look, you know, the reason why we set scientific claims that are against common sense is the key understanding of the real struggle between science and the supernatural. We will take the side of science in spite of the patently absurdity of some of its constructs, in spite of all of its failures to fulfill many of its extravagant promises of health and life, and in spite of the tolerance of the scientific community for unsubstantiated just-so stories, because we have a prior commitment to materialism. He doesn't, basically he concludes his statement by saying, we don't want to believe the supernatural because we don't like the supernatural. We have an a priori commitment to be, you know, to not allow a divine foot in the door, basically is what he's saying. And that's a very telling comment.
Yeah.
Because it's just, it's saying you exactly where they're starting from. It's, we deny anti-supernaturalism because we don't like God.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with it not being there, or, you know, that maybe it's Christianity is dishonest or whatever it might be. It has to do with their heart commitments, which are in rebellion against their creator.
Yep.
Is what it comes down to.
Exactly. Suppressing the truth and unrighteousness.
Yes. Fulfilling Romans 1.
Which is interesting because his next point is that it's extremely egocentric.
Yeah. and he talks about how everything is egocentric because it's reliant. He basically rehashes the whole thing about, you know, it's ultimately tied to its reliance on fear and everything. Mm-hmm. But they just talk about how, actually this point was kind of convoluted. I mean, he was trying to argue that, you know, he just talks about how Christianity and the belief in God is intimately concerned with all the little nitpicky aspects of, and it tries to get, you know, into people's lives and control them and everything and kind of keep them centered on, I guess you could say, Christianity or religion or whatever. Yeah. And he really, you know, it's really a meddlesome in people's sex lives. And as you move
to
the
point,
seems
to be a big focus on his.
Yes, it is. I was going to say a lot of his focus is on, you know, sex stuff eventually. And when I was just responding to that too, again, I just pointed back to a lot of, philosophers that would be in his same swimming pool, as it were, like Friedrich Nietzsche, who, yep, you know, basically created this philosophy called nihilism, and is basically everything, all values are baseless and nothing is knowable or can be communicated, and that life is basically meaningless. So he's basically saying you need to kind of focus on yourself. Yep. And I mean, you're the only thing it is, and so you need to live and live as you want to get all the gusto, because, you know, whenever you die, that's it. And it's for him to claim that Christianity is egocentric and kind of centers on itself and avoiding the fact that pretty much all of the major atheistic philosophers had some major selfish problems.
Yeah.
Is again just showing his historical ignorance of the matter. You know what I mean?
Right. Yep. Yeah, and I'm going to skip Breed's arrogance because I think the two are pretty much the same.
Yeah, argument, probably. But I can't remember. Authoritarianism.
Yeah, Breed's authoritarianism is number six, and which is like, it's just laughable looking at the 20th century. You're going to say Christianity is breeding authoritarianism after we've had Mao and Stalin and Pol Pot and Hitler.
And we currently have a nationwide concentration camp that's called North Korea, where they have pretty much killed all the Christians. You come in there with a Bible, you're going to be, you know, seized and put into one of their re-education camps there. Mm-hmm. And it's just ridiculous that he would claim that it's authoritarian when he looks completely past a lot of the stuff that he, a lot of the atheist pals that he, you know, completely ignores. I kind of mentioned about, because he gets a little bit into sexism and that sort of stuff. Yeah. And I just sort of touched on the fact that there's a lot of problems. Well, maybe we can mention this in a little more detail in a moment. But, you know, there's this breeding or this growing, festering battle that's kind of happening among a lot of atheist groups, because you have groups that are kind of polarized into these ones that are sort of pro-feminist and the other ones who are not necessarily. And the pro-feminist ones are accusing the other ones of being sexist and, you know, being these kind of arrogant, piggish guys. And the other ones are like, no, we're not like that. You're crazy. And I kind of mentioned that about Richard Dawkins, because talk about a guy who really plays the whole authoritarianism stuff up. And you read his material and carries on like, you know, Christians, they need to be totally eradicated and we need to take the kids away from the families and all of that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And it's just, you know, to, again, for Chaz to ignore that is really laughable, to say the least.
These all just flow so well together. I mean, Christianity is cruel. I mean,
And that one,
I mean, we were just talking about taking kids away from their parents. And
yeah, I and know.
What's the body count of atheistic communism in the last century? 100 million?
Exactly. Yeah, in the millions.
100 million?
Yes. And he talks about the whole idea of, he goes into talking about the witchcraft stuff. That's one of a little social media, internet trope that you might come across is that, the Inquisition burned millions of ladies, both young and old, for being witches. And he even gets that from, again, Carl Sagan's book, The Demon Haunted World, where he recounted that there was, during the Inquisitions, 5 million innocent women burned at the stake. And if we're going to be accurate, we don't want to minimize or marginalize any of the atrocities the Roman Catholic Church did when they were kind of the world power at the time during the Middle Ages or whatever. But the Inquisitions were specific periods of time. And they kind of, all together is maybe 300 years where there was actual inquisitions and you had trials and people coming to court and people being tried and found guilty or innocent or put in prison, tortured or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I just sort of did the math, and I'm not a very good math guy, but I put, 5 million women over a period of 300 years, and you're dividing that 5 million, which would be the witches burned, by the 300 years of the Inquisition, by 365 days in a year. And we roughly get 46 women being burned at the stake a day. And there's absolutely no historical record of such a thing taking place during that time. I think the closer number is you might have 30,000 witches or people accused of witchcraft who might have been executed. But that's over the course of 300 years. Mm-hmm. And not to say that that's a terrible number. I mean, I understand what the Roman Catholic Church did was wrong and horrible. Mm-hmm. But
you're not defending it.
But you need to kind of keep that in perspective. And if you're going to be padding your figures
right
to where they're extremely over inflated like that, you're losing any kind of serious credibility as a critic of what you're criticizing. You know what I mean? You need to deal with actual fact, not fantasy. Yeah.
Anti-intellectual or anti-scientific?
Yeah, it's always claimed that,
I mean, don't you kind of got to redefine scientific in order to get to that?
Yes, I mean, they do.
Going to that materialistic.
That it's basically scientism. It's right. Not, you look at the history of, Christianity, Christian church, even the Roman Catholics, and if we want to say how terrible they were, they promoted science. They promoted good science. A really excellent series of books is by a guy named Rodney Stark, who has written answering a lot of these claims, actually, dealing with how Christianity was anti-science, anti-innovation, and that sort of thing. And believe it or not, Christians were like one of the first, it was the one major in the West why medical advances could kind of take place, is because Christianity did not have this sort of ghoulish fixation on the body like you had in a lot of Muslim cultures, and they had this superstition that was kind of surrounding it. And so you would have Christian universities, that would take cadavers and they would do autopsies on them and try to figure out, why did someone die of a disease, or, how does the body function and how does it work? So you had that kind of thing. They often raise the story of Galileo, how he was this terrible, I should take that back. He was the guy who was trying to get the church away from, all of the superstitious Bible only view of looking at cosmology, and these literalists that were saying that the sun revolved around the earth, when we know now, because of Galileo's findings with his telescope, that the earth revolved around the sun. But if you read that whole affair there, Galileo was basically challenging the main cosmological model at the time, which was an Aristotelian Ptolemaic you know, made from Ptolemy, the idea that, you know, the Earth was a center and everything kind of revolved around the Earth. And so they built their whole cosmology based upon that Greek understanding of the cosmos. And Galileo was showing, well, that's not what I'm seeing with the evidence, with the visible evidence that I can take here. I'm not seeing, you know, what Aristotle was saying about the cosmos. But the Bible really doesn't say anything about that. It just says that, well, it'll say that the Earth, you know, goes up, comes up in the east and goes in the west. But, you know, we talk like that today. I don't understand why that's, I mean, you go on the Weather Channel, it says the sun rises at 6:55, the sun will set at 5:45 or whatever it is. So that's not a scientific, anti-scientific way of thinking. I kind of pointed it out to him that, you know, when you look at various atheist groups, many of them think in unscientific terms. In fact, they don't even follow their own scientific models. And I had a few quotes in there from just people who, one particular science writer, Boyce Ressenberger, who wrote this in his book about how the world works. He said, and I quote, "At this point, it is necessary to reveal a little inside information about how scientists work, something the textbooks don't usually tell you. The fact is that scientists are not really as objective and dispassionate in the work as they would like you to think. Most scientists first get their ideas about how the world works, not through rigorous logical processes, but through hunches and wild guesses. As individuals, they often come to believe something to be true long before they assemble the hard evidence that will convince somebody else that it is. Motivated by faith in his own ideas and a desire for acceptance by his peers, a scientist will labor for years knowing in his heart that his theory is correct, but devising experiment after experiment whose results he hopes will support his position." And that's how a lot of stuff works. That's not very scientific, and it's not very anti, it's not very intellectual either, if we want to consider that.
I think number nine, he jumps kind of more into, I think, what is the real issue here for him. And he starts really getting into this. He says Christianity has a more unhealthy preoccupation with sex. But I think judging by the rest of his points, you know, saving one or two here and there.
Right.
I think he's the guy that's got this.
Got this obsession
with it.
Yeah. And I know on my website, I combine points 9 and 10 together.
Uh-huh.
And kind of address them together because. The point 10 says this, 9 and 10 are together.
Yeah.
Because it's basically the same subject about sexual.
Yeah, it produces sexual misery. Was number
right.
10.
And one of the things that he kind of carries on about, and this is one of the a huge urban legend among the world, is just that Christians are somehow prudish and we don't like sex. Uh-huh. And we don't care for that kind of stuff. I can tell you right now, as a healthy man, that's not true. And I'm a Christian. And it was not true, as I point out, for many of the Puritans. The Puritans are often maligned as these prudish, you know, non-sexual people. But that's not the case. I mean, they got married and they had massive families.
Yeah.
In his book called Worldly Saints, Leland Ryken wrote just talked about this and how they had massive families. And so if you have a bunch of kids, you have 11 kids, you obviously like sex a lot. And it wasn't something that they shied away from.
Yeah.
The Bible never does that. God loves the gift of sex. That's why he's created it to be used and enjoyed in the confines of his boundaries, which he has set between a man and a woman in marriage. And so for this idea that there's some kind of misery among Christians because of this,
yeah.
Really what he, as I pointed out in the remainder of this post, what I think that he's troubled with is that he doesn't like the restrictions only to marriage. And
monogamy,
if he's like, yeah. He doesn't like monogamy.
Yep.
If he's like a lot of atheists, they want to pursue, you know, any kind of sexual, you know, encounter to the utmost abandon. They don't want to have any kind of restraints. And I would even say that they probably are bothered by, you know, even those annoying age of consent laws. No. You know, why do I need to be, you know, why do I have to be with people my own age? Why can't I be with younger people? Yeah. And it's just, you see there, you see him talking. He even says in one of his, in another point somewhere, he kind of talks about how come Christians, or how come, you know, God is such a square and he doesn't want to, you know, let people enjoy threesomes and that kind of stuff. I mean, well, obviously you're dealing with a guy who's kind of got that this perverse understanding of sex on his mind.
Right.
And, you know, for him to claim that about Christians, it's just, it's absurd. Mm-hmm. You know, most of the,
well, I think you hit the nail on the head though, talking about, you know, the Puritans who were the best at, in our recent history or our memory, at doing the best to live out their Christian faith, and they had large families. And I know, you know, I don't want to get, you know, we're going to keep this clean. We're a family show, but, you know, I know that you've
keep
got
it tasteful.
You've got careful. Five kids and I've got three and I've got another on the way. And
yep. All of the homeschooling families I know, and you know, we're in homeschooling families are usually the ones who take the brunt of all of the mockery and, you know, and, you know, you think of the Duggards and all that, they all have bunches of kids. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we recognize that big families, healthy families is what honors the Lord. I'm not saying that's for everybody. And I think God's, you know, God's given you that opportunity, go for it. But it's this, you know, it's something that we as a Christian couple enjoy and we want to see flourish with our own kids.
Right.
You know, we want to have the God-honoring understanding with sex, not just sort of the, you know, the atheist kind of do whatever you want.
Right.
Understanding of sex.
Yep. So you hit 9 and 10 and 11. Christianity has an exceedingly narrow legalistic view of morality.
And oh,
and of course, kind of in that morality, encapsulated within it, of course, is a subject we just discussed.
Yes. The he's trying to say that, I mean, I guess if you want to say that we're moralistic in the sense that we, you know, that we're somebody who we want to respect God's laws and we understand God has set a moral absolutes to work in his creation, and we see that played out, I think, in the natural realm. But you know, the when you talk about morality, they usually, when an atheist goes after morality, they're going to be complaining about the whole moral absolute aspect of morality. How can Christians be so dogmatic about moral absolutes? Yeah. And but what I always find interesting is whenever there's some kind of terrible injustice, particularly when there's a Christian who does something bad, atheists are quick to jump on that. And all of these people who have been arguing with me in angry tones about how there's no moral absolutes are automatically morally absolute that what this guy did was morally wrong. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And when Josh Duggard, you know, that scandal was sort of revealed about him from 12 or 15 years ago, I mean, all the atheists talk in Twitter is like, this guy needs to be put in jail. And, you know, all of a sudden, you know, you guys who don't believe in moral absolutes are absolutely certain he did what he did was wrong. I mean, where did that come from?
Right.
You have no room to talk, basically, with that at all.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. And that the Duggar thing just came out, you know, for those who might be listening in the archives, you know, this just came out in the last few weeks that, you know, Josh Duggar, the oldest son, had been having his way with some of his sisters, and certainly nothing that we would endorse. I mean, obviously he knew it was wrong, and his family dealt with it. And I'm just going to leave it at that. We're not going to get into the morality of Duggar, but it is interesting how that became like the thing that all the non-Christians wanted to talk about was how wicked this was. And
right.
You know, never. I always like to fall back to abortion because it just amazes me. Like, what? I mean, obviously that's bad. I will agree with the the God haters, the left, that is wrong, that he shouldn't have done what he did. In fact, even he would agree with that today. But I always fall back to abortion. Like, it's amazing. You can kill this child, before it's born, you can kill it. But right, once it's born, once that baby comes out of the womb, let's go back to this breeds authoritarianism that you had in number six. Okay. I mean, it is just sickening. Like, you can kill this child before it's born, but once it is born, you better not give it a potato chip that has been fried in trans fats, because you are going for away for life.
You better not let them wander around in the yard by themselves.
Oh, yeah.
We'll call CPS on you because you've got these.
Your
kids are unsupervised. You know?
10-year-old kids walking home from the park four blocks away unsupervised, and its parents are.
No, and they come down. I know, it's quite amazing, isn't it? At any rate, that to me is just one of the more amusing things about that whole, the atheists and the morality, because they have no basis for that. If you're going to claim that we're stardust, that we are, we just sort of evolved over millions of years and, just kind of diverse, strange circumstances is just right. Why does it tell us that, living like this is a particularly wrong way to live just because you don't like it? Or they'll try to find some ways to say, well, there's some innocent victim, or, it's taking advantage of someone else or whatever. It's like, well, so what? If it's doing that, who cares? Right. Who's to tell me that's wrong? Maybe that's the right thing to do.
Well, a lot of times they'll fall back on legality, and they'll say, we're going to define our morality by the law. And, that doesn't work either, because it's easy to go back to.
If the law changes.
Well, it's easy to go back to 1930s Germany, 30s and 40s Germany, and say, murdering Jews was legal. It was completely legal. Does that make it moral?
Yep. I hear what you're saying. There's even a book that talks about how, I think the name of it is Neighbors. I cannot remember the title of the author of the book, but they just talked about how you had Jews and Germans and, Polish people, Gentiles, I guess, living side by side in relative harmony, and no one bothered anyone else, and they worked together. And then the Germans came in and took everything over and told them, well, you can kill your Jewish neighbors. And it's like everything changed all of a sudden. It's like, okay. And so they would kill them and take their property. And it was just, it's terrible. If you have someone that changes the law, they're going to change the law quite possibly regarding, gay marriage.
Right.
Are we going to, all of a sudden, like, okay, we got to start marrying men and men and women together in church? Well, no, we're not going to do that, because we have a higher authority over us. And, it's just an inconsistency on the part of the atheist to argue in such a fashion.
Right. Now, we got six left, and I think we can do it if we,
we could probably run through these.
If we run through them. I'm gonna lump the next two together, because I think they can be addressed.
Which ones are those there?
Christianity sanctions slavery, and Christianity is misogynistic. I think we
can. Okay. Yes, let's look at those two real quick. Yes, the claim is, and honestly, you could do a whole entire show looking at the various passages. I've interacted with a ton of atheists. I even have some other extended articles answering this question. The claim is that when you read in Exodus, you particularly read in the Torah, it talks about how when Israel would go in and they conquered the promised land, got rid of all the pagans that were there, well, then you could take them as slaves and they would be your indentured servant. They also appeal, the atheists will also appeal to Ephesians 6:5, where it talks about, slaves serve your masters. Same thing is repeated in Colossians 3:22. And, honestly, those passages need to be considered in their context, what's being discussed. It's typically the mindset is, well, they kind of project, 1800s Southern slavery and the Civil War and all of the things surrounding that to ancient history 3,000 years ago in the ancient Near East. And, you know, the rules that God set down for a nation state of people that he was intimately involved with is obviously going to be different than it is involving the rest of the world now in the church age, now that we're, you know, God's plan is kind of expanded around the globe. But none of those things were really dealing with slavery as we know it.
Right.
It was, in a lot of those instances, it was definitely a design to kind of protect a person who had gotten into financial debt, who needed a way to, you know, protect his family and to be able to work and to pay off his debt. So he would basically indenture himself to this other rich family who would take care of him, take care of his family and so forth. Right. And there are obviously little passages and stuff in there that, you know, the atheists will probably, you know, little nitpicky points that they'll mention, but I know when you start to look at them in more detail, they're not saying what they're claiming they say.
Right. And then,
that's actually,
they rarely, if you know, I don't think I've ever heard them go to, you know, the Exodus and how the Egyptians had the Hebrews into a bondage, you know, a slavery that might be a little more akin to 19th century America.
Oh, and yeah.
What did God do with that? I mean, he didn't sanction that. He said, let my people go. And he drew them out.
And he basically brought the world superpower at the time to their knees.
Right.
And where they couldn't even function for several years afterwards, you know. Mm-hmm. The next one about the misogyny is rather interesting, too, because it's going to kind of claim that the Bible basically teaches, you know, that women are chattel, that it's men are kind of the boss and they can walk all over women, that sort of thing. And he hits on how, you know, women are, they have all these uncleanness laws that are kind of connected to their monthly cycle and so forth. And, you know, men don't have that. And so it's all, you know, this misogynistic kind of literature. I find that claim of misogyny interesting coming from a guy who is really wanting to argue for any kind of sex without any kind of restraint and to have threesomes and all this other kind of terrible stuff.
Yeah.
And it's just a joke for him to argue against the, you know, Christianity this way. And what I thought was kind of interesting is when I was researching this point, two or three of the people that he mentions in this very point, Mary Wollstonecraft, who was an early 18th century atheistic feminist, she was the one who gave birth to the gal who wrote the Frankenstein novels, mm-hmm. Mary Shelley. Well, Wollstonecraft was involved with an artist named Henry Fuseli, yeah. Who was an emotionally troubled painter, and he had a lot of hang-ups towards women. She also was involved with a guy named Gilbert Imlay, who was one who got her pregnant and kind of left her for another actress. And, you know, for him to kind of talk about misogynists among Christians and to sort of overlook the very women that he sort of mentions as these stalwarts of, you know, feminist virtue and, you know, these intelligent women and so forth, and the, you know, terrible relationships that they got themselves involved with that were misogynistic and abusive to them. It's just crazy. Mm-hmm. The Mary Shelley married Percy Shelley, and he was a terrible womanizer who was, you know, got her pregnant and kind of left her for another man as well, or another man, I mean, another woman.
Right.
And left her by herself. He went to go womanize on the European continent. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just a joke. But what I think is really kind of troubling is in the modern day, you have, as social media has become more popular and as the internet's become more popular, you essentially are getting groups of atheists that come together for conferences and so forth. And they're beginning to have their little get-togethers once a year, almost like a, I guess, an atheist version of a shepherd's conference. And you have these big speakers that come in. Well, in the last few years, there have just been these allegations of just sexual assault, serious allegations of of date rape and things of that nature among these groups. I think it was Michael Shermer is probably the one who's really been come under the gun. There's been other men as well who have, I think Ben Radford, who's another atheist writer, he had his feminist ex-girlfriend accuse him of some stuff. And you have these polarizing atheist wars that are starting to take place over this subject. And so you've got this skeleton that's sitting right there among all the atheists who are supposed to be these enlightened, virtuous, pure of heart people that Chaz kind of claims they should be, that are basically living like these terrible misogynistic Christians that he's accusing the church of being, you know what I mean? Uh-huh. And yeah, I've got some links there in that particular post to some of these allegations, if anybody wants to follow that up. I actually saw that Michael Shermer was debating, I think it was Frank Turek or somebody, within the last month or so. And I left a comment on Facebook. I said, ask Shermer about these allegations. Mm-hmm. You guys are going to be arguing about morality. What does he think about these allegations, the morality of those? But I never heard anything out back about that, though.
Sure. I have a point to make about all this sex talk, and I think I'd like to weave it into the next point, which is that Christianity is homophobic, because I think the point works just as well with that as with the rest of them. But talk about that a little bit, and then I'll get to my point.
Well, I actually left. I was kind of posting some of the comments, you know, from his article. This particular one was rather gross. And I didn't really, I just linked people to it. Hey, if you want to go and read his comments about this, please do. Yep. But I wasn't going to put him in my thing. And he goes on to just talk about how Christians are homophobic and how they mistreat homosexuals and stuff. And, you know, it's rather odd that in the last, several years, I mean, we've really seen it escalate in the last couple of years, just this growing, for lack of a better term, this Gestapo, who have taken over our culture and are demanding equal rights and all of this other stuff. And
who ironically usually seem to be very cozy with the Islamic movement.
Yeah, no, that is kind of ironic that they are cozy with the Islamic movement. And the Muslims are going to turn around and kill them if they happen to get their way. Right. But the claim is that Christianity is homophobic, and that homophobic being obviously you're afraid of homosexuals. Right. And, you know, I have no qualms to point out that, look, you know, homosexuality is a sin, that it is condemned in scripture. That doesn't mean that we don't show respect and love to our fellow human beings caught in a sin. Christians can't be, you know, homophobic of individuals if they're going to give them the gospel. We know we need to be in the world of evangelizing them.
Yeah.
But we need to recognize that this is a grievous sin that does a lot of destruction to a lot of people. And you can kind of see in this perversity knows no bounds. I would not encourage anyone necessarily go looking too deep on the internet, but I mean, there are a lot of, I put in here, there's a lot of gut churning, revulsive things that are, that you can see just on some of their street fairs that they have in San Francisco. And, it's foolish to kind of think that that's not a lifestyle that is destructive.
And that's the kind of thing I've heard so many stories about, and I'm just going to take people's word for it. I'm not going to go do anything.
It's something you do not want to go and pursue, but there is a bondage, and we were deceptively foolish if we're going to claim that, this is something that is not, that's healthy and normal and we need to support. And if you want to call that homophobic, to stand against that and to stand against and to stand for common decency, I guess that'd be so be it, But I know the only way they can get out of that is through Christ and Him alone. Amen. Who can rescue them from that sin.
Yeah. Now, the point I wanted to make, and it fits with homophobia or the homosexual point just as well as any of the other sexual points the guy makes, and that is that this guy's own, his morality cannot be informed by his worldview, and it's impossible. Because even his own worldview, if you were to just for a moment, let's just disregard the Bible and let's just assume that atheistic evolution is correct and that's how we got here. Still, how can you justify living a life that is not monogamous? How can you justify homosexuality? I mean, you can't do it even through an atheistic evolutionary worldview, because we're supposed to have evolved to a point where we are above that. That we're going to do what's best for humanity, for our species. And running around sleeping with everybody you can possibly get into bed is not going to further the species. That kind of thing breeds disease and death.
Right.
Whether it's heterosexual or homosexual. And that's...
Well, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, it just really irks me that they can attack our worldview for our morality when their own worldview would not, if you put it together logically, allow for such a thing. They should be in the same page we are on as far as sexual ethics, even based on their own faulty worldview.
Well, I wrote another article that's not, you know, in this series. It's on another section on my blog, but it had to deal with just how homosexuality itself is really... it's not supported in evolutionary theory. So if you're an atheist and you're arguing for, you know, homosexual practice, that's almost a self-defeating argument against evolution. Evolution, by its very nature, says that you have to, by its very own philosophy, is, you know, the organisms, you know, reproduce themselves into the next generation. Mm-hmm. You cannot do that with homosexuality. Two men can't reproduce. You know, it's detrimental to the human species. And I think I even pointed out, it's almost like it's a mutation. So in a way, homosexuality should breed itself out because they can't pass on those traits. And right. So there's something wrong there with that. If you're going to look at this from a strictly Darwinian biological evolutionary fashion. And I had somebody talk about, oh, but the penguins, there were these two penguins in Japan. They were two male penguins that were coupled together, and they tried to hatch a rock that they thought was an egg. And I'm like, there are two penguins in a zoo in Japan. They're not penguins in the real world of planet Earth, where a seal, a sea lion or a killer whale would eat them. They cannot reproduce. They would die out in their generation in the wild. Here, though, you know, human beings are not like that because we've got the scientific, you know, ability to, you know, do artificial insemination or whatever it might be, and we can play around with that stuff. But, you know, when it comes down to it, it's not healthy to the species. If you're an evolutionist, you shouldn't even pursue that lifestyle.
But,
you know, what do I know? I'm just an ignoramus Christian. You know what I mean?
Don't be using that logic now.
Separation of church and logic. We can't have that. Anyway.
All right. We got three left, and we're going to do, I can never remember what, if you watch James White, he's got his dividing line and then he's got his megas and his jumbos, and I can't remember which, but, you know, we're going to go into, is it a mega, I guess? Are you going an hour and a half instead of an hour?
Are we going? I guess that's correct.
Is that a mega or is that a jumbo? I can't remember.
Is that a jumbo? I can't remember.
Yeah. So, well, we'll just have to go there and try to wrap this up. I hate to leave us with three left and when we're just a little over an hour in. But number 18 claims that Christianity, the Bible is not a reliable guide to Christ's teachings.
Yes. And that had to basically do with him claiming, I think I put points 18 and 19 together because they were similar in their challenges. So they were they're under one point. But you're exactly right. The whole idea there is that
it's not a reliable guide. And then the next one, number 19, you mentioned is the Bible's riddled with contradictions.
No, it's not reliable. And then it's riddled with contradictions. anyway, the whole point of that is, that's probably the new, I think most people are going to be involved in discussing the Bible's reliability with their you know, relatives or their friends or whatever who are challenging Christianity. That's usually where they hit on, you know, whenever they talk about, well, what about this Bible verse that says this? Or what about this Bible verse that says that? And, you know, honestly, when you start to kind of go through their arguments, you can tell that they quickly do not know what they're talking about whenever they're pointing out stuff to them or they're pointing out stuff to you. And so when you start to respond to them, the thing I kind of notice about atheists is, or any skeptic or unbeliever, is you'll try to provide them an answer. And the first thing they're going to do is, rather than take what you said and kind of consider it in light of what they're challenging,
they're already mentally three.
They're already
three moves ahead.
And I'm trying, you know, and I usually tell them, if I get in one of these discussions, I ask them, okay, tell me, what is the one silver bullet argument you think proves your point? And if I can answer it, you know, will you become a Christian? It's usually what you challenge them with. Of course, they're going to be like, oh, no, I'm not. And and then they'll give me their point. And when you try to, and when you answer it, you know, they're going to be, well, I don't know. What about this? And, you know, they don't really stick with their, they don't really stick with the rules of engagement. Yeah. He lists a few examples. He talks about, I'm trying to remember. I'd have to go there to immediately to his question. He had like a few examples that he points out in his thing, like the whole thing with Genesis. Oh, he at the first one here is James 1:13, where it says God cannot be tempted with evil, neither tempteth he any man. I like the way he goes right to the King James. Yeah. And it came to pass after these things that God did tempt Abraham. That's in Genesis 22:1. Well, of course, he's not talking about, you know, you have to go to the context of what Genesis 22:1 is talking about with Abraham being tested for his faith. And then in James 1:13, talking about, you know, how trials come into believers' lives. And the point of the trial is not that God is tempting you to sin. That's what it's saying there. Yeah. God will test us, but how we respond to the test just demonstrates the reality of our faith. Is what's getting, that's what James is kind of getting to. You know, Chaz, obviously, like any atheist, doesn't want to consider those facts. It's amazing how skeptics and people like this can be some of these, you know, greatest self-proclaimed experts in the subject of the Bible. And then when you actually start to talk to them about it, well, you know, it just sort of falls apart on them and start getting into some serious questions and whatever.
They're all scholars.
I know. They come together and it's like,
never read it before, but they're scholars.
I know. And they know all about ancient and Near Eastern religions and ancient languages and cultures and we just,
yeah, that's the last one. Why don't we go there? That's the last one. Christianity borrowed its central myths and ceremonies from other ancient religions.
Yes. This is probably the, one of the more recent and popular arguments. It really started with a German philosopher, Bruno Bauer, who kind of fabricated this idea that the whole concept of Jesus and his resurrection and all that were taken from ancient sources, other religions, and these Jesus myths. There is a ton of good, solid refutation of these arguments online. J. Warner Wallace, if you're familiar with his
Standard Reason,
cold case Christian, he works with Standard Reason now. He has some really good articles on this. The one that Chaz kind of hits on is Mithra, and Mithraism flourished shortly after Christianity was founded. And, when Christ came, it was connected primarily to the Roman soldiers. And it was a religious cult that flourished among the army men who were in the Roman army. Mm-hmm. And it's a mystery religion. And we only know about it because some of these things exist. And we dug up some of their hidden chapels and meeting places. And, when I took this apart and just kind of looked at it, I just laid out maybe four main arguments Number one, there were mystery religions that flourished throughout the ancient world around the first century with Christians. But the one place where they really didn't flourish was in Israel, because Israel banned all that stuff and they, you know, learned their lesson from the Babylonian captivity. Yep. Secondly, Christianity was a public faith, meaning that they went and publicly proclaimed and evangelized around the world, whereas mystery religions like Mithraism kind of flourished among these exclusive little groups that you had to be in the know about. You had to come together. You had to know where they were meeting. They had secret knowledge, and they held that stuff secret. They wouldn't just let anyone know that. You had to be a certain order of Roman soldier.
First century Bohemian Grove kind of thing, right?
Yeah, exactly. Or Scientology in a way they kind of are. And, you know, and the thing is that when you look at the documents of these things, they don't really match what Christianity teaches. It's ridiculous that they would make these claims that there's all this borrowing and all these similarities when that's just not the case. Even the main experts who have written on Mithraism and some of these mystery cults who, you know, will note that there's too many differences and there are similarities. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just not the case. And it's interesting when you look in the Acts record, and I guess the atheists could argue that it's been edited to show this, I don't know, but when they encountered the ancient Greeks in the world of Rome and Paul was on his missionary journeys, you never had them, anyone saying, oh, that sounds like a mystery religion that you're giving us about this Jesus rising from the dead thing. That was never an issue that Paul addressed in any of his letters or any of the other apostles addressed. They addressed certain aspects of like Judaizers and certain kind of Gnostics, which maybe that would be fit in there. But they made sure to distinguish between, you know, those religions and what the truth of Christianity is. It was not the same thing, the same claim that they borrowed from one another. But anyway, there's a lot of really good material I link in that article that you could probably go and research that more. I actually had someone raise that argument with me, I want to say within the last 6 or 7 months. I can't remember where it was, or somebody had come across a friend or a loved one or somebody that asked them about this, and I got to talk to them a little bit about that. And yeah, so that's one that's currently a popular way to argue against Christians, but it's bunk whenever you start to, you know, look at it in any kind of detail.
Well, again, if anybody missed it before, this is episode 86. So when I post the final episode, it'll be at echozoe.com/86, and I'll have links to, first of all, the article that, well, there's several articles actually that we just went over. We worked through. And also some of that stuff that you've referenced in the course of the discussion. But we made it. I don't know how we got through. I think it's that going to the Jumbo or the Mego or whatever.
No. What was the final time?
Well, my recorder right now is at 1:19. So.
Oh, okay. That's good. That's not too bad.
People listening, I don't know what that'll be in the final thing, because we add some.
They're probably all. They're all. They're tuned out.
Thanks, Fred. I enjoyed it. Of course, I've enjoyed getting to know you a lot since we did the King James Only.
You know, it's been fun. We'll have to do it again on something else. I don't know what it can be.
Well, I only do one a month, which is 12 a year, so it'll be a while. But
maybe next year something else. I don't know.
Yeah, we'll find something. I love having you back, and I enjoyed it. I think this is a good one. As I said at the beginning, it's a good topic for Christians to be able to address as people go through these objections. Not necessarily for the sake of the objector, because like we said, I think a lot of times these guys are going to be, you know, 2 or 3 moves ahead by the time you address them and knock them down. They're already moved on to their next thing. They're not listening. But, you know, there's people watching. There's people listening. And they might not be engaging in the conversation, but they're paying attention. And when they see you address these objections in a clear and logical and concise way, you know, it's going to do the Lord's work. So
Yeah, I think most people that I've, you know, when I've written these kind of articles, and I've done a number of topics, you know, not just atheism, but conspiracy theories and all kinds of things that, you know, people encounter in their Sunday school class or whatever. I think how, you know, they see someone has actually wrestled with these issues, and they see them provide a biblical, coherent, you know, theological response. And it's something that really encourages them and builds them up. And, you know, there's, you know, there are answers there. And I've told all my kids, you know, say, look, guys, you know, now you're not going to walk away from this house, you know, in rebellion against the Christian faith and say that you did not have answers. I better not hear you go on YouTube or Facebook and say, oh, I never got my answers answered or my questions answered, because I will come haunt you. Yes, you did. You just didn't want to listen.
Yeah.
So there are answers there. I think a lot of these guys just don't want to hear them.
Well, that's it. You know, those quotes you gave of the naturalistic evolutionists that flat out say that, you know, they're bought lock, stock, and barrel into their materialistic worldview, and they're not going to move from it.
You're exactly right. And only by the grace of God and a miracle in the heart.
Amen.
And so, all right, man.
Well, I know you've got some kids to go retrieve from VBS, so.
Yes, we do.
We'll stick with, I'm going to assume Mega was the 90 and the Jumbo's the 2 hour. We'll stick with the Mega on this one.
Okay, man.
But thanks all so right. much, Fred.
All right, see you later.
Echo Zoe Radio is an outreach of Echo Zoe Ministries. If you are blessed by the show, please consider offering your support. There are many things you can do to help, including prayer, sharing the show with others, and your financial support. Echo Zoe Ministries is a registered nonprofit organization with 501c3 tax-exempt status, and your donations are tax-deductible. For more information about how you can support Echo Zoe Ministries, please visit echozoe.com/support.
That wraps up episode 86. Thanks for listening to Echo Zoe Radio. For show notes, visit echozoe.com/86. Don't forget to follow Echo Zoe on Twitter. It's at Echo Zoe. Or like us on Facebook at facebook.com/Echo Zoe. You can also add Echo Zoe to your Google Plus circles by going to plus Echo Zoe. If the next episode is arranged with enough advance notice and our guest is open to it, we'll be trying to live stream the interview on YouTube as we did with this episode. Watch Echo Zoe social media feeds for information on when and how to tune into that. Also, be sure to get your copy of Jerusalem's King, our new film that tells the redemption story and spans all of biblical history. You can get a digital download at echozoe.com/store or a DVD or Blu-ray at jerusalemsking.com. Lord willing, I'll be back next month for the July 2015 episode of Echo Zoe Radio.